Guardian Holiday Offers is pleased to bring you a great selection of worldwide trips from our trusted partners. From cultural tours and adventure holidays to river cruises and cottage breaks, we have something for everyone. To find your perfect break, go to guardian.co.uk/travel with us. That's guardian.co.uk/travel with us.
The Guardian.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly and I'm Tom Clark. Coming up this week, David Cameron's Halloween nightmare. A rebel motion to cut the EU budget defeats the government in the Commons as Labour joins in the Brussels bashing. As the European Union plans to award itself a 5% budget rise, has David Cameron been left alone in a European no man's land? The Great Stagnation. Living standards in Britain are collapsing for most people, according to a new report, and it's an issue destined to define the election of 2015. How will the parties respond? And as America clears up after the devastating East Coast hurricane, could the freak weather have affected the outcome of the election? Joining me for all of this, we've got The Guardian's political columnist, Martin Kettle, The Observer's economics editor, Heather Stewart, and the chief executive of the Resolution Foundation, Gavin Kelly. A warm welcome to you all. Now, in a week of scary movies and Halloween horror shows, it was the ghost of John Major's government that's returned to haunt this one, with plans afoot in Brussels to raise the EU budget by as much as 5%, despite austerity elsewhere. The Conservative Eurosceptics joined with a mischievous Labour Party to lay down a marker in the Commons. Calling for a cut in the budget as opposed to the freeze David Cameron had been arguing for, the rebels carried the day with a majority of 13 votes, leading to David Cameron's first substantive defeat in the House of Commons. So, Martin, we'll come to the domestic politics of this in a moment, but just where exactly does it leave David Cameron? He'd got Europe asking for a 5% rise, rebels were demanding a cut, he was proposing a freeze, which seemed like a kind of split the different sort of position, but the fence he was sat on has collapsed.
Well, it's a slightly bigger fence than that still. So it's, if we continue the metaphor, I mean, quite a lot of it still exists. And that's largely because actually the UK is not alone in the EU in wanting to pare back the Commission's plan to have a 5% increase in the EU budget. And most important of all, Germany is on the fence and is part of that too. Angela Merkel is coming, I think, next week to see Cameron, and that's what they're going to be talking about. So, I mean, in terms of the politics, the high politics of the European Union and sort of disregarding everything else, I mean, Cameron is still in the game, it seems to me, with all of this. But, I mean, he is obviously terribly weakened because the debate is just a reminder that he is a weak leader of a coalition which is split down the middle on this question in a country which is sliding more and more rapidly into a kind of fundamental Euroscepticism, but without knowing quite what the alternative is.
So, I mean, Heather, the rebels, normally we're used to thinking of these kind of Bill Cash-like figures looking like they're almost foaming at the mouth to denounce the evil works of Brussels, but aren't most people just going to think they're completely right on this? Every other budget's been cut. Why shouldn't Europe's budget be cut too?
Yeah, and remember, this is also going on against the background of a deep crisis in Europe, you know, the Eurozone crisis, which we've all watched rolling on. And you know, George Osborne can stand up and say this has hit our economy hard, which it has, you know, so that the sort of political background music is, you know, this is not a project in Europe which is going brilliantly. So, of course, we should be sceptical about demands for more money. I mean, the fact is, however, that, Cameron has to negotiate for this. He can't. You know, he can't just say up with this, we will not put, and walk away. So, you know, the politics of it at European level are difficult. But I think public opinion, yeah, will fall quite clearly behind the rebels, I would have thought.
But who then, Martin, what's the sticking point here? Is it that the elected leaders of Germany and Britain, you've already mentioned, think that 5% pay rise, budget rise for the Commission is too much? I'm assuming that in stricken Greece and Italy, where they're cutting budgets left, right and centre, they're not going to be keen, I suppose, to increase European budgets much more either. Where's the resistance going to come from then?
Well, I think the resistance, if I understand you correctly, the resistance is in most capital cities, because politically Europe is governed by a whole succession of weak governments, all of which are vulnerable domestically if they get public spending wrong. They're all cutting, and so they're all in a difficult position. They're all in a bind over this.
But I suppose some of them get this money, don't they?
Some of them are net recipients, and some are net contributors. I mean, to hear the debate in this country, you'd think that the whole thing is financed from the UK and that everybody else is just engaged in going to large lunches in Strasbourg on the proceeds. That is not what this... That is not what this budget is about. This budget is about actually very practical things, some of which are very badly run, some of which are very corrupt in some ways, the common agricultural policy primarily amongst them, the EU structural funds. But these are actually quite important things. These are about trying to redress imbalances between sectors and between regions. And so, you know, we're not actually talking about, you know, the Brussels gravy train the whole time. But that's the way the debate takes place in this country. So, it's almost not worth trying to make these points in the current atmosphere.
One of the things that's been quite interesting, though, has been that it's not just, I mean, you're right, the Germans are in an interesting position here, because it repeatedly, you know, each time there's been a kind of crisis summit on the Eurozone, which requires the sort of creditors, as it were, the rich countries to put up more money, you've started to hear these voices more, I think, in Germany, in Finland, for example, in Austria, other sort of creditor countries, other countries that sort of pay in, bankroll the rest of the EU, as it were. So, UK in some ways probably has more allies in making this kind of argument than it has for some time, I think.
I think that's true, and it's true in Northern Europe in particular, because, I mean, all the Northern European countries pay much more per capita into the EU budget, almost without exception. But so does Italy. Italy is a larger net contributor than the UK, which you wouldn't imagine if you were just basing what you know from what it said in the Daily Mail.
Now, but this is where the economics rubs up against the politics, isn't it? Because if you're going to create a sustainable single currency, you're going to need probably far larger transfers of resources from the rich north to the struggling south. And actually, whether the politics of that will work out, I think, and how that plays out will be one of the things that determines the future of the single currency over the next kind of
a frightening
5 years or so.
This little event on the House of Commons floor shows how insoluble the Eurozone...
Well, that's not in David Cameron's hands, I don't think. But
crisis so. Is... Gavin, in a former life, you worked for Gordon Brown, and we're at number 10. He had a very turbulent premiership. We've just been looking up. He lost on the floor of the House of Commons, I think, three times. The one people will remember was over the Gurkhas. The others are on really obscure stuff like the East Midlands Grand Committee or something.
Oh, where goodness. It was going to... I think Varing's a distant memory. Yeah.
But this is what I was going to ask you, because...
I remember the Gurkhas very well, but not that one so well.
How big a deal, you know, was that seen as? Just like losing on the Gurkhas, a fairly special interest subject, but just that...
It depends very much. I mean, the fact that I can't remember very well one of them, but I can remember vividly the other, tells you that it varies massively. And it depends. I mean, the Gurkhas mattered a lot because it was leading the news for, I think, 3 or 4 days, 6 o'clock and 10 o'clock. And it crystallized, you know, it was kind of an unpopular Gordon Brown up against, you know, the Gurkhas and Joanna Lumley. And that was only going to finish one way with hindsight. So... But it captured a sense that the media were running with at that time of not in charge, not having a grip on events and so on. And that's why it felt so bad. I think this vote is important. And so in that there is, on this issue, you know, as we know, and as history has taught all of us, the Conservative Party is capable of eating itself. And so therefore, and there was not much love lost between various different bits of the Conservative Party on this issue, and indeed with the leadership. So it just sort of stokes up an underlying sentiment, which is not a happy sentiment for them, and brings it to the fore in a way which is not terribly helpful. So I think this, you know, the government's not going to fall because of it or anything else like that. So in that sense, it doesn't matter. But I think in terms of the tone of our politics and the tone of the coalition and the Prime Minister's capacity to oversee his own party, this matters.
So the authority thing, in a word, Martin, Tony Blair didn't get defeated at all with those crushing majorities in his first two terms. And then around 2005-06, in a few months, there were three or four defeats, which all came on civil liberties issues, the freedom to criticise religion, 90 days terrorism and so on, in short order. And it did sort of create the sense of the beginning of the end for him.
I guess it certainly contributed to that. I mean, I think he was already a bit, you know, historically he was on the slide by that time. But it was quite a long and gentle slide. And I think those issues, in a sense, could be compartmentalised in the way that Gavin is talking about in relation to the Gurkhas. Bad thing to happen. Government doesn't like it. Everybody's blaming everybody else. But when it comes to it, the government goes on. Nobody's actually saying the government can't go on.
Yeah.
I agree with Gavin about this, that it's quite what's damaging is tonal and cultural, because... And, you know, yet again, you'd have to remind yourself that, you know, we're in a coalition. And, you know, so the main governing party is a weak party. It's a divided party. The coalition, although it's united in being a coalition, is a coalition of people who disagree with each other fundamentally over Europe, as Nick Clegg is outlining in a speech that he's just given this morning. And also the... You know, Britain's position in Europe is a weak one. So, you know, the ability to affect events, Cameron's ability to affect events and show leadership, strong leadership, is very, very hamstrung at the moment. And I think we may see other things happening. But as soon as Europe is on the agenda in any shape or form, he's going to get clobbered. It's clear that this is going to be repeated further down the line, because basically the Labour Party is prepared to be a Eurosceptic party in parliamentary terms if it means defeating the government. I mean, I'm not saying Labour is a Eurosceptic party in its heart and soul, though I begin to wonder. But, I mean, I think that the tactics and the opportunities are just too irresistible.
In terms of the big issues in British politics, I think Europe is interesting because debates on public spending or so, you can imagine there being quite passionate divisions within each party. When it comes to European Union, of course, there'll be different shades of opinion within the Labour Party, and some people would probably feel a bit squeamish about last night. Others wouldn't have felt at all squeamish about last night. But actually, the Labour Party is not going to split, I don't believe. The modern Labour Party is not going to split over the politics of the European Union in a profound way. And so I think it is possible for them, and they've got a pretext because of the shifting, you know, nature of public spending and so on. I think it's possible for them to do this in a relatively united way, whereas I think the Conservatives are just fundamentally in a difficult position on this. So, and there's not many other issues like that.
But we're so used to saying that the Conservatives are split over Europe, but haven't we nowadays, Martin, got to be a bit careful? I mean, on the radio this morning, Sarah Wollaston, one of the most appealing new generation of Conservatives, a doctor who was getting some very kind of pragmatic incremental changes on the health bill, doesn't seem like a cut out and keep politician at all. Seems like she's entered it in 2010 because she cares about the issues. But she's leading the charge on this rebellion. And it makes you think that even these people who are very moderate Conservatives in that new intake are very, very Eurosceptic. I mean,
the Conservative Party is divided on Europe, but it's not split on the EU. I mean, it's basically a Eurosceptic party. It's led by a Eurosceptic. It has a cabinet stuffed with Eurosceptics, apart from Ken Clark and possibly George Young. It's, you know, its backbenchers, as you rightly say, including the younger generation, are Eurosceptic. That's not really an argument. The interesting thing is what happens when you're in government, because, I mean, actually, Cameron, even Osborne, certainly Hague in this government, have actually become quite engaged in the European process, because actually, as part of the European Union, much of your day, many of your issues involve you in European negotiations, meetings, and so on. And actually, they find those quite effective, because they can do more. You know, for the original reason why we're in the European Union, because you can do more together than you can do separately. And you know, that's a reality for ministers. It's not a reality for backbenchers.
I think that's the absolutely key point. I think they're relatively united and wanting to sound fairly sceptical in tone. But in the hard reality of governing is that you have to do lots of deals day in, day out, exactly as Martin says. And it is what you do when you're actually engaging with the institutions of the European Union. And I think I'm sure that some of the Tory backbenchers would actually like a kind of direct oppositional stance on all sorts of issues. And that is not the revealed preference of the Prime Minister and others in the Cabinet. And so that is the nature of the division.
That, wouldn't you? I mean, life would become impossible.
It's very hard to govern in this country.
Yeah. And I mean, just looking a little bit further down the line, you know, as we get closer to the 2015 election, when people are going to start, there's going to be a huge amount of talking about referendums on Europe. I mean, the reality is that the referendum about which Cameron is sort of edging towards is a referendum on renegotiated terms in which Eurosceptics don't know which side to vote for, because if they vote for renegotiated terms, they're voting yes to remaining in Europe. If they vote no, they're voting for the status quo. So they don't have a dog in this fight. And for them, that's very, very painful. And that's, I think that in a kind of underlying way is part of what's driving this mood on the backbenches, that what they want is to get out. And they're like UKIP. They don't want to be in the EU. And, you know, and unless and until the government seems to allows them to, they're going to go on being cross about it.
OK, well, let's leave that there, but they're going to keep being cross about it, as Martin says. So you don't need a sixth sense to realise that we'll be returning to this story before too long. Now, it was a truth held to be almost self-evident in post-war Britain that every generation will be a touch better off than the last. Progress in technology, science, medicine and the opening up of world trade would enrich everyone. And for decades, that proved a justified hope. But then suddenly, and rather rudely, it stopped. A new report by the Resolution Foundation spells out in stark terms what that means. By 2020, a typical family of modest means will still be worse off than they were before the bubble burst. Now then, Gavin, it's your report, or your commission's report, I should say, if I'm being proper. What's caused this big squeeze?
Well, I think it's right to sort of emphasise that this kind of rhythm we long had through kind of, you know, my lifetime up until about 5-10 years ago of the kind of gain in national GDP being reflected in your rising living standards is just sort of part of the deal that we have, if you like, with the market economy. It's part of our social contract, our psychological contract with capitalism, you know, that if you work hard, you sort of get on a bit each year. That's sort of how we, that's how we were led to think about these things. And I wouldn't say that our commission report says that that's over, because that would be, you know, who knows what the future holds. But that relationship is fundamentally been frayed, and it was, and we learnt that during periods of steady economic growth for a number of years prior to the financial crisis.
So this is pre-crash.
So this is pre-crash. From around 2002, 2003, we saw wages, particularly for men, there is a bit of a gender difference here, wages be completely flat for men. But we also saw household incomes in the kind of lower half of working Britain, if you like, also going flat. And the only reason that stopped them actually falling was the very sharp increase in tax credits, which was actually a big kind of push upwards, if you like, for those households compared to what would otherwise been the case. So something fundamental was going on, and the question was, what happened during those periods? What has changed?
So where did the money go? You're saying this was a time when there was serious economic growth.
Yeah.
You're also saying most households weren't really getting any of that extra money. Were companies sitting on it? Were rich people?
Yeah, there was. It went to a number of places. There was a significant increase in the slice of GDP going to profit. So that was a change, and it happened in those years, and that is part of the explanation as to why we saw what we saw. There was also a increase in the cost of employing people. Part of that was deliberate policy. You know, the government put up national insurance. That meant less money was left over to go to wages, so kind of that bit of GDP went elsewhere. And we spent more money as a country on pensions and other things. So the amount of the GDP going towards wages got kind of eroded in that period, and that played out in pay packets. At the same time, at the very, very, very top of the earnings distribution, we saw people doing rather well.
Is
particularly
the 1%?
The 1%, yeah. What's interesting about this phenomenon is that actually applied the squeeze, if you like, in earnings applied not just to sort of the, you know, the bottom 10, 20, 30%, which we've seen before. We saw that in the early 80s. We saw that other times. This applied actually to the great majority of people, working people, but it didn't apply to the very top. So there were a number of different reasons where the gain in GDP didn't find its way into the pockets of people on low and modest earnings and incomes in that period. And I think the question is, what can we expect going forward, even if we manage to secure steady economic growth, which is obviously a long way from being a given. But even if we do manage to secure that over the next year or two and thereafter, will the trends that led to this problem arising pre-recession just sort of melt away for some reason, or can we expect them to hang around and sort of cause us problems in the future? And I suppose our conclusion was that if we just sort of carry on as we were, there's little reason to think that we won't have the same problems.
Sounds like an economic nightmare, Heather, but also a political one. I mean, it's all very well having
parts of the country doing badly, you know, the deindustrialized north in the 80s or whatever. When you're talking about the majority being hit over a number of years, it's going to be pretty hard for any government to stay in power, isn't it?
And there's also some cause and effect here as well. You know, there are some macroeconomists, Heiner Fleschbeck at the OECD, for example, who are now starting to argue that driving wages downwards in order to create jobs, or real wages downwards in order to create jobs in the way that we have, it affects demand, depresses demand, and takes away from growth too. So, you know, actually,
so the wrong sort of growth led to the bust.
Yeah. So if you, and actually, you know, if you want to generate growth, you need to make sure that those people at the bottom of the income scale get a better share, because they're more likely to spend it and more likely to increase demand. So you know, for sort of macroeconomic reasons as well as for sort of fairness reasons, you want those people to get a better slice of the pie.
So they spend money where other people might invest it in property or something.
Economists call it their propensity to consume. They're likely to spend every penny they get instead of sticking it away somewhere in a, you know, in a yacht or a property or something that doesn't, you know, doesn't create many other jobs for anybody else. But politically, it is extremely difficult. And I think you could see that a little bit from the way that both sides of the political divide responded to the return to growth last week. You know, George Osborne was extremely careful, I think, to say, you know, this is not thanks to us, this is thanks to hardworking people, and it's not over. Because he knows that people are going to look at the headline saying recession is over and think to themselves, well, not for me, it's not. You know, and it used to be that you could ride back to power. You know, we had these sort of boom-bust cycles, and you could ride back to power at the next election because the economy bounced strongly out of a downturn. Well, our economy is not doing that. The US economy is not doing that. And, you know, people are going to feel that even if we have got growth, you know, of a reasonable pace, that it's not, they're not feeling the benefits of it.
Martin, we had Michael Heseltine, Tarzan, swing back into action yesterday and come up with a list of proposals that may or may not get some growth. But the context for that then is you've got to make sure that the proceeds of that growth are shared round. Otherwise, the government's not going to get credit for it.
Well, that is true. I mean, and it's very interesting. I mean, Heseltine's report said many of exactly the same things that Gavin's just been talking about, in terms of, you know, this is not a conventional, this has not been a conventional recession that we're talking about. Mm. We're talking about something more structural, and that this is something that has to be seen perhaps in a global context too, and is going to affect all the European economies, which have been used to the kind of trade-offs that we've just been hearing about. And, you know, I think politically, you know, we're into a bit of a new world here, in which, you know, credible politics is going to be about doing the best with what we've got, rather than promising, you know, large-scale change and a bigger pie from which everyone can prosper. At least, you know, well beyond 2015, I suspect, you know, maybe for quite a large period of all of our lifetimes. Certainly mine. I'm older than anyone else around the table, but I think that you know, that we really are in, we're into a different phase now in Northern European industrialized countries and their politics, and everybody is having to adjust, and it's very difficult, and nobody has got the right answer yet.
You can be quite modest about that, can't you? And you can say all that we can do is try and redistribute a little bit with the tiny, you know, with the shrinking pie, or stretching the pie metaphor slightly. Or you can start to be quite radical, perhaps, and say, you know, I've just come back from a huge conference of the world's cooperatives in Manchester, you know, and the argument there, we have 90 countries and about 7,000 people there from all over the world. And one of the arguments there is actually maybe the shareholder-owned model of capitalism that we've come to rely on doesn't really deliver for ordinary people. You know, you can take this, you can either say, gosh, we're going to have to be terribly modest and shrink the state and think more, you know, think differently about things. Or you can say, maybe we need to quite radically rethink. And some of the things in the Commission on Living Standards report on, you know, kind of wages boards, I'm not sure you called them that, but Ed Miliband's predistribution, notion of predistribution, I'm not sure what he thinks it means, but at one level you could say, you know, you need an incomes policy. Well, that's terribly old-fashioned and, you know, and quite radical, but maybe you need to, you know, maybe the whole model we've been basing economic policy on has collapsed to some extent. We need to have a real radical rethink.
So how bold then, Gavin, do we have to be? I mean, you've obviously set up a huge problem here about the economy. The headline recommendations of your reports on the policy recommendation side were, you know, a bit of fiddling with some tax arrangements around older workers.
Sure, they didn't put it like that.
And an improved offer on childcare. Whereas Heather here is talking about the overthrow of shareholder capitalism as we know it. Where do you come down?
Well, we had, I mean, it's first, we chose to approach this by working with big employers, trade unions as well as leading economists. We went into this trying to find the kind of common ground that people who start from different places could find on this issue. Yeah. And that you know, that leads you in a certain direction. It probably doesn't lead you to the barricades. It leads you to sort of, you know, I would say incrementalism, but it kind of, it shuts down certain avenues when you I don't apologise for that. I think that was the right approach, but I'm just being clear, that's what we did. I mean, I think we were sort of in between. There were certain things we didn't look at, which I think Heather rightly raises, which I'll come to. But I think there are quite radical things that you can do to make work more attractive, which go well beyond anything we've done so far. So I do think having a much more ambitious childcare system. You may think, what on earth has that got to do with economic policy? Well, actually, in a world where you know that rising female unemployment was probably the single most powerful force for lifting prosperity in the bottom half working households for some years. And you also know that your current childcare arrangements are just a straightforward blockage to that happening again. It's a big deal, not a small deal. So I think that's important. But I also think in terms of wages, and this is a kind of a conversation which I really think we need to have, and it's, you know, not just this week, but over the next few years, I think that, you know, the national minimum wage, which I was involved in, and I think, you know, was a great thing. But actually, I personally believe we need a more ambitious account of what needs to happen to lift low wages in this country. We have a pervasive problem of low pay in Britain, almost more so than any other OECD country. And a minimum wage is not going to solve all that for you. So I think you need to find new ways of pushing up low pay in sectors which can wear it, which is not all sectors. And that means kind of having differentiated approaches, creating new institutions and sectors, trying to give labour a bit of countervailing power that it hasn't had for a long time, but in the current world, not trying to turn the clock back. That's all really hard stuff, but that's the world we're going to be in. You asked about some of the kind of the more radical side of things. The things that we didn't get into, and which I think, you know, it's not a new debate, but it's probably got a new purpose. It's just sort of getting inside the company, if you like, and sort of saying, could you rejig how you manage and oversee power structures within kind of corporations within this country to tilt rewards away from shareholders towards employees? That's a really hard thing to do, and we don't answer that question. In part probably because of the composition of our commission. I think that does need to be part of our debate. But anyone who thinks that you can just change the law and it's all going to take care of itself is kind of wildly wide of the mark, because it is a lot more complicated than that.
And Heather's agreeing with that. But what about this question of how active a stance the government should take about what industries get bigger and what things get smaller? You know, I mean, historically, we've in the UK pushed, say, the arms manufacturing industry. Beyond that, we've tended to sort of say, leave it to the market. Do we need to move to an industrial policy that says we're going to have industrial champions, and those champions will be the type of jobs with better pay and better promotion prospects?
Yes, but as my answer to that, yes, because I passionately believe that we should have a more activist industrial policy. And I think that there are certain sectors where that can make a real difference. And you need certain traded sectors to be a kind of balanced economy in the modern world. So I'm all for that. But, and this is a very big but, we are deluding ourselves if we think that those traded sectors are going to be the mass labour-absorbing industries of the next 20 or 30 years. They're not going to be. Anyone who says, in my view, that we're going to double or whatever, significantly increase employment in manufacturing because we're going to have a more activist industrial policy, I think is deluding themselves. That is not the world we live in. So we do need activism. We do need to ensure that we have a balanced mix of industries in this country. But I just think the truth of this is that the industries or the sectors which are going to be mass employing in terms of new jobs over the next 5, 10, 20, 30 years are much more likely to be elderly care, personal services, a whole range of other sectors, not those which people usually talk about when they talk about an active industrial policy.
I see. So no easy answers, but an awful lot to think about there. But let's leave that and zip over to America for one last time before next Tuesday's election. After the continent's eastern seaboard was hit by Superstorm Sandy, the political campaign was temporarily put on ice. I asked our US bureau chief, Ewan McCaskill, what it would do to the election.
I was just listening to a conference call with two of Obama's advisors, David Axelrod and Jim Messina, and they were asked about the impact of Superstorm Sandy on the election. and they wouldn't get involved. But they did say that it had frozen the campaign for almost all of this week, or at least the first 3 days of it. So they don't want, no one is making political points or talking about gains as a result of Sandy. But the feeling is, you see it, Obama is in New Jersey looking at the sites of the sort of stricken sites around Atlantic City with the New Jersey governor. And while Obama's doing that, Romney's out on the campaign stump down in Florida. And it's just this, the two images, the image of Obama being presidential, dominating the scene, being commander-in-chief, and it just Romney looks weak. In fact, CNN were covering Romney's speech, and after a few minutes, they just abandoned it in sort of mid-sentence. And that shows how much of a priority. So this could be a sort of pivotal moment for Obama. It might be people will decide that, you know, he's a president, we'll give him a second chance, and Romney might stop any momentum that Romney's had. So I think it's basically been a pretty good week for Obama.
The polls remain nail-bitingly close, but you've just come off the phone to the president's closest advisers, you were saying not long ago in a conference call. What's their mood? Do you think they sound like they think they're going to win?
Well, will they do? Axelrod and Messina were saying that Obama is tied or ahead in all of the swing states, and they have an edge in early voting, which is true. The trouble is, traditionally, Republicans are good at coming out on election day. They tend to be fairly disciplined and make the effort to go to the polling stations, whereas Democrats can be a bit more apathetic. They might say beforehand that, yes, they go to vote for Obama and they support Obama, but not actually. They're distracted on the day, or they're distracted by the weather. They can tend to be a bit more apathetic. So it's whether that early advantage, that firewall that they've built through the early voting, will be sufficient to hold back the Republican hordes on election day. But as a sign of confidence, David Axelrod repeated in this conference call, he said that the Democrats, Obama, will win the sort of Minnesota, Wisconsin, and if they didn't, he would shave off his moustache. So that's a sort of sign of his confidence.
So, Martin, you in there saying it's good news, probably, for Obama, after all those millions, or is it billions even, of dollars going on campaigning, do you think it could all come down to an act of God?
No, I think it's an act of man and woman that's going to decide, and woman in particular, that's going to decide the outcome of this. I mean, this election is basically between American women who are going to vote for Obama and American men who are disproportionately going to vote for Romney. And so the question is, you know, are the women and the Democratic vote properly energized after a very difficult economic time of four years and some disappointments compared with the hope which on which Obama was elected in 2008 on things like the war on terror and Afghanistan and Guantanamo and healthcare indeed in some respects. So, you know, and it's going to be won, I think, at the ground level. I mean, I think it's to do with organization and campaigning. And if Obama wins, which it looks to me slightly more likely now that he is going to, you know, it will be a major triumph because incumbents do not win elections at the moment. Look around the world and you see government after government that has fallen in these economic hard times, including the one that you were part of. And, you know, that's, you know, it's indiscriminate to the left and the right, pretty much. So I think if he manages to win this, that's quite a big triumph. It would also be a huge indictment of the Republicans for having moved so far to the right, but that's a bigger question for another occasion.
Heather, so it's obviously difficult for the president to win in such stricken times. But if you think back 4 years ago, the famous question in American politics, are you better off than you were 4 years ago? 4 years ago, of course, it was already getting very, very bleak indeed. Do you think, on average, on balance, you could say the record for Obama on the economy is positive?
Yeah, I think you probably could. I mean, unemployment is still considerably higher than you would expect. I mean, we'll get new figures on this actually on Friday, but you know, unemployment is still considerably higher than you would expect it to be at this stage in recovery, and it's not clear at all that it's sustainable. And actually, you know, whoever wins next week will have a real struggle with the politics of trying to prevent huge spending cuts that are due to take place next January until there can be, unless there can be a sort of deal on Capitol Hill. So I think things are marginally better, and I think he's played his cards quite well. But I think, like a lot of other major economies, you know, the US is struggling to achieve sort of liftoff, really struggling to achieve a sustainable recovery.
Gavin, do you think Labour could have won with Barack Obama in 2010?
Well, he was pretty popular in this country at that particular moment in time, I remember. So,
no, I just mean with the recession and everything, if he does win, is it a personal triumph? Like, or do you think it's that people don't trust the alternative?
I think I agree with Martin. If he does win, given what he's been through and what they've been through, I think it is a major victory. And I don't think that's how people are gearing up to view it. But actually, I think, for exactly the reasons Martin says, to win, given the last 4 years, is quite incredible. I tell you, he'll be pleased that their terms are 4 years, not 5 years, because if he'd been around for 5 years, then he would have been around during a bit of sunlight before it went dark as well, and that would have made his job infinitely harder. So I think the fact that he came in exactly when he did helps, but I do think it will be
as bad as they could get.
Exactly. But if he does win, I think, you know, no one should underestimate it. That is a major achievement.
Well, let's wait and see if he does. But that's all we've got time for now. My thanks to Martin Kettle, to Gavin Kelly, to Heather Stewart, and to Ewan McCaskill, who we heard from in Washington. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Tom Clark, and thanks very much for listening.
Guardian Holiday Offers is pleased to bring you a great selection of worldwide trips from our trusted partners. From cultural tours and adventure holidays to river cruises and cottage breaks, we have something for everyone. To find your perfect break, go to guardian.co.uk/travel with us. That's guardian.co.uk/travel with us.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.